every Alaskan has a different situation that they find themselves in, and this money is a tremendously fortunate opportunity to take care of the needs of their families.
The Revenue Department announces this year's PFD amount. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, is the wacky Alaska weather related to record ice melt in the Arctic? One scientist says maybe.
It's exactly the kind of pattern that we would expect to see occur, so it's very possible.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Revenue Commissioner Brian Butcher announced the amount of the permanent fund dividend this morning at a news conference in Anchorage. After keeping the audience in suspense for a few minutes, he finally opened a sealed yellow envelope.
The amount of the 2012 dividend this year is $878.
Butcher noted that the amount was low compared to recent years, but not even close to the historical low in 1984, when the PFD amount was $331. The dividend amount each year is based on a five-year average of the fund's investment returns. And Butcher says 2009 is weighing on those calculations.
As long as the fiscal year 09 year that lost in the billions of dollars from as we all remember, the late 2008 drop in the stock market. As long as that year is part of the five-year calculation, it's going to be a little lower. So next year's dividend will be the last year that that down year will be factored in.
The highest PFD amount was distributed in 2008 when Alaskans received $2,069 for the PFD and a $1,200 Alaska Resource rebate. The oldest applicant this year was 107 years old, and the youngest was born to eligible parents just before the new year. Butcher says the dividend checks have a big effect on the economy, and he likes to think about how the money helps average Alaskans.
The opportunity folks have to either go out and do things that they'd like to do with the money, plan a vacation, a big purchase, Christmas gifts, or catch up on their mortgage payments, catch up on their bills. Every Alaskan has a different situation that they find themselves in, and this money is a tremendously fortunate opportunity to take care of the needs of their families.
The money will be direct deposited in bank accounts on October 4th. Checks will be mailed out that same day from Juneau. The PFD's Pick, Click, Give program had its most successful year ever. Alaskans are giving away more than $2 million of their dividends to hundreds of nonprofits around the state. The annual PFD could have been accompanied by energy relief for Alaskans, but the idea died before it ever made it to Governor Sean Parnell's desk last spring. Two Interior Democrats say Parnell could still call a special session later this fall to address the state's energy crisis. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
It's the smallest PFD in 7 years, and it would have been accompanied by a 250-gallon fuel voucher if Democratic Senator Joe Pasquin of Fairbanks had had his way.
This crisis is real. This is beyond politics. This is something where people are saying, we need help now.
Senator Pasquin and fellow Democratic Senator Joe Thomas, also of Fairbanks, sponsored Senate Bill 203 last spring. It created the fuel voucher program. It was the only energy relief legislation to pass during this year's legislative session. Republican Senator John Coghill of North Pole was one of four senators to vote against it.
They were saying it was about temporary relief, when in fact it was installing a permanent entitlement program, which I just fundamentally disagreed with. And if I'd have been on a committee that we could have talked about it, then maybe we could have hammered out some of those details.
The bill did not pass in the House. Senator Thomas says one solution for this winter is for the governor to call a special session following the election in November.
If they have some concerns about it, it doesn't take long to rewrite things and put a plan forward. And in a special session, you could expect that in a week or two or 3 weeks, whatever. You could certainly get through the basics of it and come up with something that satisfies your idea, unless you just simply are opposed to the philosophy of it in general.
Senator Coghill says he'd support a special session.
But if the voucher is the only thing on the table, I would say it's probably not the best thing because they're looking at an entitlement. I'd much rather put money into production of energy, whether it's natural gas, doing something with royalty oil. If we did that, you get my attention.
Senator Joe Thomas says a natural gas trucking project is the best option to get cheaper energy to Fairbanks in the near term. He says that plan is in the works. Meanwhile, both Thomas and Senator Pascvan plan to bring the voucher program back to the legislature during next year's session, should they be reelected this fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Buccaneer Energy's jackup rig Endeavor was originally supposed to be in Ketchikan Bay for only 6 days before moving on to drill near Tyonek on the west side of Cook Inlet. Due to work being done on the massive rig, however, it has been in place outside the Homer Harbor for almost a month. And now, as KBBI's Aaron Selvig reports, the rig has done something that is normally not allowed in Ketchikan Bay. It has lowered its 410-foot legs down to the seafloor.
The last time a jackup oil rig put down its legs in Ketchikan Bay was in 1976, when the Standard Oil-owned George Ferris rig set up in nearly the same spot that Buccaneer Energy's Endeavor is in now. After the Ferris became stuck in 80 feet of mud there, an underwater demolition team had to be called in to blow the rig's legs up in order to free it. That incident produced an oil sheen that stretched for several miles, and the resulting public outcry caused the state of Alaska to rescind all oil leases in Ketchikan Bay and declare it a critical habitat area. When the Endeavor extended its legs to the bottom of the bay last weekend, it was not to drill for oil or gas, of course. It was in response to a massive windstorm that wreaked havoc all over South Central Alaska. Homer Harbormaster Brian Hawkins says that his staff and the crew of the Endeavor prepared for the storm by using two high-powered tugboats to hold the rig in place.
We were concerned that with the wind speeds that they were estimating would be as much as 60 and 70 knots, that they may not be able to hold it.
As of Tuesday afternoon, the legs were still down. Hawkins says that is in preparation for another round of windy weather forecasted for Tuesday night and Wednesday. One troubling byproduct of the incident, says Hawkins, is damage that occurred to the city's deepwater dock when the Endeavor slammed into it. Hawkins says the city of Homer will charge Buccaneer Energy for that damage. Another problem for Buccaneer is the potential consequences of violating the state's rules regarding the Ketchikan Bay critical habitat area. Jenny Litchfield is a habitat biologist in the Soldotna office of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She is the one who will ultimately decide if Buccaneer has violated Ketchikan Bay's critical habitat designation, and if so, what the penalty might be.
Right now we're awaiting documentation of the decision-making process and how, you know, it all came about. So we have to review that information prior to making any determination on if it violates the plan or not.
Litchfield says she expects that documentation by the end of this week. She would not comment on whether an exception to the designation might be made for an emergency situation, nor would she say what the potential consequences could be. Hawkins says Buccaneer's crew on the Endeavor has been, quote, a pleasure to work with. He says the company has provided an economic boost in the form of dockage and other fees paid to the city and temporary jobs created aboard the rig. Hawkins says he does not know when the rig, which arrived in Ketchikan Bay August 24th, will be leaving for its first planned drilling project near Tyonek on the west side of Cook Inlet.
When it first arrived, they were hopeful that they would be here for 6 days and then be off to work, but they just keep finding more and more work that needs to be done, and so they just keep postponing their departure.
Attempts to reach executives for Buccaneer Energy through the company's public relations firm, JMR Worldwide, were unsuccessful. KBBI News will continue to try to reach Buccaneer to comment for this story. In Homer, with an assist from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, getting ready for that important rite of passage, the first day of kindergarten.
Put on your clothes, brush your teeth, wash your face, comb your hair, pack your bag.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Another wind and rain event is going to wallop south central Alaska starting tomorrow morning. The National Weather Service is forecasting high winds to peak on the hillside and along Turnagain Arm by late morning, with gusts up to 85 miles per hour and gusts to 110 miles per hour. The storm will hit East Anchorage by early afternoon, with winds peaking at 45 to 60 miles per hour. National Weather Service lead forecaster Sean Baines says the good news is the storm won't last long.
We expect the winds to rapidly diminish late tomorrow afternoon into the evening, such that we're going to be back to a light and variable situation, I would say, by 7 or 8 p.m. tomorrow evening. So it's looking like, for the lowlands at least, a very short duration event.
Anchorage could see up to 3.5 inches of rain over the next 3 days. The same system is likely to bring even heavier rain to Prince William Sound. Rivers near Cordova are already swollen, especially the Eyak River. The Resurrection River in Seward could also flood, depending on how the storm tracks. Bain says the long-term outlook shows the Anchorage area should have a break from the wind after tomorrow, but the rain will not let up for Prince William Sound. He says a funnel of moisture from the subtropics is pointed right at south central Alaska.
That pipe of moisture coming up from the tropics looks like it's like a fire hose, and it's going to remain pointed somewhere in the Prince William Sound area, perhaps for another 5 days. So I think flooding might be the concern in the longer term.
The hydrologists say the storm pattern is reminiscent of 2006, when record flood levels were set in Cordova and Seward. Line repair crews have restored power to most of the Tok area, and work continues in Tanacross and the Alaska Highway community of Dot Lake, which are still blacked out due to damage inflicted by Sunday's storm. About 300 homes are still without power as of this morning, and probably will be for the rest of the week in several areas around Tok. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports from Delta Junction.
AP&T spokesman Mark McCready says the utility has called in linemen from other communities around the state that it services to help replace numerous broken poles and repair other damage.
We have two Haynes linemen headed to Tok. We have one Skagway lineman headed to Tok, along with another truck.
Meanwhile, despite blustery weather throughout this part of Alaska again today, residents are still cleaning up and repairing other damage from winds that in some areas gusted in excess of 70 miles an hour on Sunday. The Tanacross School's roof is one of many that took a beating. Alaska Gateway School District Assistant Superintendent Scott McManus says the school is closed until the roof is repaired. He says its 10 students are now attending classes in the district's main schoolhouse in Tok.
They're getting lunch and breakfast, and they're given classroom space and are being instructed by the same teachers that they would have out in the school.
McManus says that he, like many other area residents, woke up Monday morning with a barricade of downed trees in his driveway, requiring him to haul out the chainsaw to get to work.
We had to cut our way out of the driveway. I had 15 trees down across the driveway. My power line was knocked down on the driveway.
McManus grew up in the village of Ambler in northwestern Alaska, so he's no stranger to powerful storms. But he says Tok usually doesn't get slammed with high winds like Sundays, so it took even him by surprise.
I don't have any idea how strong the gusts actually were in terms of miles per hour, but, you know, I've been in storms that were clocked, and it was definitely, it was wicked.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Arctic sea ice still will hit its minimum any day now, and freeze up will begin again. But the extent of this summer's melt has already smashed the previous record set in 2007. Scientists are starting to draw a link between Arctic ice retreat and unusual weather around the world. Jennifer Francis, a research professor at Rutgers University, is immersed in this emerging area of science. She says Arctic ice melt is altering the jet stream waves that govern weather patterns, causing them to move more slowly.
What we're seeing then is that as the Arctic gets warmer, as the ice recedes, and which enhances the warming even further, that we expect that these waves in the jet stream will continue to get larger, which means that the weather patterns are going to move more slowly. And as they do, that means the weather we feel on the surface, whether it's nice weather or terrible weather, is going to last longer. So that's what we believe is the connection between the Arctic sea ice loss and weather patterns in mid-latitudes.
How quickly does something like that have an impact? Is this summer's record sea ice melt already having an impact on the jet stream?
Well, it's really hard to say for sure whether it's having an effect at any given moment in time. I mean, the jet stream does a lot of meandering all by itself. It always has, and it always will. But our research suggests that it could be. And the pattern that's actually existing right this moment, I was just looking at the weather projections for this coming week. The pattern that the jet stream is in right now is exactly as I described, with these big waves and big excursions southward and northward. And so over Alaska right now, there's a big southward dip in the jet stream that goes right down south of the Aleutian Islands. And it looks like it's going to stay there for a while. The model output that I just looked at suggests that it'll be there at least through the middle of next week. And so what I would expect to see is a continued period of very wet, stormy weather for you all.
Well, having said that, then, we have had, as you may have seen, we've had several unusual wind events much earlier in the fall than we normally see. And based on what you're saying, do you think they're related?
I think it's possible. I think it's exactly the kind of pattern that we would expect to see occur. So it's very possible, but I can't say for sure.
Given that the melt is only supposed to accelerate, what do you think we are looking at? What can we expect in the future?
Well, we're to the point now where there's so little ice left in the Arctic Ocean that I wouldn't expect there to be a lot more extreme weather frequency occurring. I mean, I don't think it should continue to get worse and worse if, in fact, this connection is really true. And the weather records just don't go back far enough to really say for sure that this is actually occurring, because the ice has only been disappearing really for the last few decades related to, you know, greenhouse gas increases. And so we're still trying to tease out these relationships based on a relatively short data record. But looking forward, you know, we don't expect the ice to recover. And so I would expect to see a continuation of enhanced extreme weather.
The models for ice-free Arctic summers have changed dramatically just in the last few years. We went from researchers and scientists saying it's 100 years away to 50 years away to now it sounds like it could be a handful of years. Are there new thoughts about when we may see these ice-free summers?
Well, I think, you know, the observations have been telling us that the ice is disappearing faster than the models are able to capture, at least most of the models. Some models actually do capture the ice loss at about the right pace. But I think the real question here is when is ice loss enough? You know, at some point, you know, there's a little bit left, and does it really matter? So, you know, you could almost argue that we're already at that point, because the ice that's left is so weak and slushy and broken that it really is not acting like sea ice anymore to some extent. There is some thick ice left, but very little. So You know, in some ways, that ice-free criterion is not all that important, and really we're almost to the point where it's acting like an ice-free ocean where we can reliably have ships going up there, and, you know, we're almost to that point.
Jennifer Francis is a research professor at Rutgers University.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Last week, federal judge John Sedgwick dismissed a lawsuit over Usabelli Coal's mining permits for the Wishbone Hill mine near Sutton. The suit had been filed in federal court in May by groups opposed to the mine. Judge Sedgwick granted a request by Usabelli to dismiss the case. However, Judge Sedgwick did not rule on the validity of the permits, which are in dispute. State officials claim the permits are valid, while opponents of the mine plan say the permits have expired. That matter is being weighed by the Federal Office of Surface Mining. Tim Leach is the conservation director for Friends of Mat-Su, which filed the suit against the mine permits.
The court decision of Judge Sedgwick did definitely cast serious doubt on whether Usabelli's permits are valid. And certainly the decision that he made was a procedural issue and did not look at the substance of the actual argument. And that is something that we are still waiting on from the Office of Surface Mining with regard to whether those permits that Usabelli has are invalid or not.
Matanuska Susitna Borough Assemblyman Warren Keough is sponsoring a resolution to be heard by the Borough Assembly tonight, asking the state of Alaska to conduct a comprehensive health assessment regarding impacts of coal development in the area. Keough says Usabelli's project is only one of many slated for the borough. Two Australian companies are moving into the valley. Riversdale, Alaska, has secured coal leases and exploration permits for the Chicoloon area, and Ranger, Alaska, has development permits for the old Jonesville mine in Sutton. Warren Keough.
And together they comprise an area of about almost 32 square miles of land. If we pass this, and if the state agrees to do it, it would be an assessment of various health impacts, both positive and negative, of having a large-scale coal mining in the Matanuska Valley.
In September of last year, the Mat-Su Borough Assembly approved a resolution in favor of Usabelli's Wishbone Hill project. Baranoff Elementary School in Sitka has more kindergartners than it planned for this year. As a result, district officials hired an extra teacher just 5 days before the start of school. They say the scramble was worth it, as the first days of school are among the most important in a student's education. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
It is 7:30 a.m. inside the Hitchcock household, and 5-year-old Connor is getting ready for his first day of school.
Put on your clothes, brush your teeth, wash your face, comb your hair, pack your bag.
He grabs a blue backpack with soccer ball patches and his name embroidered in green on the front.
Mom, this didn't go in there.
It doesn't go in your backpack, your folder?
I know, but it doesn't go in that place in the backpack.
Oh,
it goes in the second one.
Okay.
A short car ride later, and Connor is on the playground at Baranoff Elementary School. He surveys the dozens of children who are running around, steps onto the gravel, and finds the line for his class, but not before looking back at Mom and Dad. And with that whistle, the students head inside to start the day. Connor Hitchcock is one of 120 kindergartners enrolled at Baranoff Elementary this year. That is a dozen more students than last year. Principal Michelle Beach says about 10 families registered students in August.
And when that happens, that's why we end up at the last minute trying to kind of scramble and add another teacher, because if we had known of those numbers in the spring, we would have known that our, you know, what our population was going to be, or had a better feel for it.
The extra students raised the student-to-teacher ratio in Baranoff's 6 kindergarten classrooms to approximately 20 to 1. School officials thought that was too much, and they quickly decided to add a new teacher.
It happened very fast. In fact, I'm still trying to catch up.
Rachel Sorokin was hired on a Friday afternoon.
And I was ecstatic. I was jumping up and down and so excited about that and couldn't wait to get started. Little did I know it meant getting started in just a few hours, because then I was right in the classroom getting it all ready for the first day of school.
School started the following Wednesday. The addition of a new teacher was fast and expensive, an extra $75,000 when you factor in salary and benefits. It means kindergarten class sizes are now between 16 and 18 students instead of 20 or more. But Principal Beach and teachers agree that small change makes a big difference.
Kids that are crowded are not happy kids.
That's Linda Fredrickson, Connor's teacher. This is her 23rd first day of kindergarten, and she sees the same thing every year.
It becomes an issue of, you're sitting too close to me, or he's touching my stuff. You know, kindergartners are pretty egocentric. They're concerned about themselves, and it's really hard for them to see that they're in a classroom of 18 to 20 kids.
Fredrickson says low class sizes mean better learning, and a body of educational research supports that theory. The most comprehensive study was called Project Star, conducted in Tennessee in the mid-1980s. It compared classes with an average of 15 students to classes of 22 to 25 and found an increase in achievement in the smaller classes.
I like the way Connor's taking that apart. Joey, can you take that apart?
Back in Fredrickson's classroom, playtime is over. The students sit in rows on the floor and listen intently in front of a big easel marked Morning Jobs.
So this morning, there were lots of things we had to do to get ready for school. And I bet there's lots of things you have to do in the morning to get ready before you come to school.
Like Connor, sitting in the back of the group, chimes in.
I have a list so I already do that.
So you have a list in the morning that helps you remember? That is so funny, Connor, because we have a list in kindergarten, too.
Fredrickson says young children require a lot of attention because they are still learning how to sit quietly, listen, share, hold a pencil, and eventually get down to work. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Tim Ellis in Delta, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Project Management Institute will present 3 one-day seminars at the Petroleum Club of Anchorage, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Expert Neil Whitten will present No-Nonsense Advice for Successful Projects, Let's Talk, More No-Nonsense Advice for Project Success, and The Gift of Wisdom, Work-Life Balance for Today's Managers, Learn to Manage Projects, and more. Registration information at pmiak.org. This message sponsored by Project Management Institute, Alaska Chapter.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.